This particular lesson, these first nine lessons have been out of a book that Brother Wendell Winkler wrote on leadership. This particular lesson is a kind of a one-off out of that. It's from a lecture that he did on the topic of leadership, and so I've taken the notes from that and tried to compile them into kind of an outline that would work for this class. And the reason I did that is because there's a lot of, and I, what does he have, 15 or 16 different areas? How about 17 or 18? 18 of them. Just different areas where he kind of tries to drive home the point that we have an impact on people just by our example. You know, there's certain things that we can do in trying to steer people through our words, but our actions, the example that we set, it's one of those things that we need to focus on, we need to pay attention to, but do we always realize how individuals are following our example? You know, sometimes that's unknown. You know, we can say words to somebody and expect, okay, these words are going to have an impact or they're going to do, you know, something based upon what I've said in these words, but the example that we set, we don't always know when somebody sees that. We don't always know when somebody's following that. And so that's an ongoing thing that we've got to reflect upon. You remember his couple of verses up here at the top. You remember what Paul told Timothy, that Timothy was to be an example. And it depends on what translation you have. Some translations say that Timothy was to be an example to the believers. Some translations say that he was to be an example of the believers. Well, which one was it? Both. He was to be an example of the believers, what the believers, what Christians look like, and he was to also to be an example to the believers so that they would know what a Christian ought to look like. And then in 1 Peter chapter 5, in the discussion about the responsibilities of elders to shepherd the flock, he mentions the fact that elders are to be examples to the flock. So again, an ongoing awareness of just the influence that we have through our everyday conduct. So I want to go through these various areas that he lists here, and I want us to think about each of these, and then just ask ourselves a question. And it doesn't matter if we're elders or deacons or who we are in the church. The reality is that we're going to set an example. All of us are going to set an example in each of these areas, regardless of who we are. So, which means we've got to be a good leader in these areas. First one, number one, is leaders must lead in the area of evangelism. That ought to be pretty obvious, but that's the first thing that he mentions here. And so it's interesting what he says on the first point. He says, the work of the church is not expressed in evangelism, edification, and benevolence. Well, that might come off kind of strange because we often break up the work of the church into evangelism, edification, and benevolence. But his point is that instead of focusing on those three distinct areas in the work of the church, we've got to realize that the Lord's one mission that he's given to us is winning the lost for Christ. There's two people in here that go back to the Bill Hatcher days. Bill Hatcher used to kind of hone in on that truth that everything the church does ought to be focused on reaching the lost. And as a result, what does that do? And, you know, when you focus on reaching the lost, as a result, what that does is it helps to, oops, let me go back. It helps to edify. I thought I had evangelism, edification, and benevolence up here. But it helps to edify the church. The more you get the church involved in reaching out to the lost, that as a result builds up the church and edifies the church. And anything that the church does in benevolence always needs to be focused on saving souls. That is our primary responsibility. And so our responsibility is not just to help people with their financial needs. There's a bigger need that they have, you know, that whether they are able to get their light bill paid or not is one thing. Whether their soul is saved, that's a whole nother thing that we've got to be focused on in our efforts. And so I like what he says in letter C. Leaders must equip members with three things, with confidence, with skills, and with tools so that they can go out and teach others. The members of a local congregation must see their leaders actively engaged. in seeking and teaching the lost. So that's not just a program that they see happening. That's just something they see in our personal lives. And so as we go through each of these, maybe get out a mirror and think, okay, is that me? Are there others in the church when they look at me? What do they think? What do they see? What is it? What kind of example am I setting? Am I setting an example that says, I am concerned about reaching lost souls? Do they see me inviting other people to services? Do they see me taking materials and giving it to others? You know, not that we, not that we sound a trumpet, to use Jesus's words, not that we sound a trumpet and say, hey, look at me, look at what I'm doing, and draw attention to ourselves. But just through our daily conduct, is that our, do we recognize that to be our primary mission on this earth? So page 90, number two. Leaders must lead in the area of conservation. It almost looks like the word conversation. Some of us lead in that area very well of conversation. But he's not talking about conversation. He's talking about conservation, which kind of follows up on if we're doing what we need to do in evangelism, then that's going to be helping people to be converted to Christ. And so our responsibility then is to help conserve, to keep saved those who are converted. Is that a need in the church? Is our responsibility just to get them baptized and say, okay, good, we got you in the water. Now learn to swim. Learn to live as a Christian. What did Jesus say about making disciples? Baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And then what do we keep doing? We keep teaching them. They've got to be taught. They've got to be trained. And so that's what letter B is. New converts need to continue to be taught and grounded in the faith. When you read the parable about the soils, and you read about the wayside soil, and then you read about the stony soil, it says that the seed sprung up. And so it actually grew. There was something that came from the seed, and it immediately sprang up. But did it last? It didn't last. Why not? Well, because the soil was very thin. It was stony soil, rocky soil. That's the name of the soil. So what was the deal? The roots couldn't get down in any deeper. So do we ever have new converts that they learn what they need to do to become a Christian, and they respond to the seed of the gospel, and they spring up, and then what happens? They wither. Why? Because their roots can't go very deep. Well, what do we need to do? We need to help them to have their roots go, you know, is there a hard soil? Is there a hard rock underneath some of their lives? Yeah, there is. And so we need to help them in a number of ways. Letter C, we do that by helping to get them assimilated into the work, and helping them to find something that they can do as a part of the work of the church. And so really, when it comes to new converts, I see us needing to do three things. And these aren't listed here in this order. But when it comes to new converts, I see us needing to educate them, getting them educated in the faith, and that's what letter B is all about. I see us needing to get them integrated into the work, and that's what letter C is all about. And then the third thing is I see us needing to get them assimilated into the family. I want you to think about those three things. We need to get them educated. What does that mean? Their faith needs to grow so that their roots can get deep. They need to be integrated into the work. They need to feel like they've got something to do in the church. But then they've got to be assimilated into the family. What does that mean? They need to feel like they're a part of us, not an outsider, not continually needing to break into, you know, the various groups of the church. They need to feel like they are a part of the family here. And so all of us can be involved in one aspect of that or the other. But conservation, when we hear of some, and, you know, at what point do we stop doing that, by the way? I mean, when they're 3 months old as a Christian, I mean, are they far enough along? 6 months old? They can graduate, right? They've graduated from being a new convert. Now they're a season, a year. I mean, and I don't know where you draw that line. But sometimes we draw it too quick, don't we? When you have a baby, some of you have had babies, right? When you have a baby, sometimes we read about Samuel when he was weaned, that his mother left him with Eli. Well, what does that mean? What does weaned mean? Does that just mean that he was taking solid nourishment now? And so Eli could, you know, give him, you know, bananas and soft carrots now, and so he was good to go. Oh, I think he was a little further progressed along than just being able to pull up his own diapers and being able to feed himself the soft food. And so we've got to get somebody to where they can stand on their own two feet, and that they are then going out and converting more souls, and then they are involved in conservation of those souls. Dan?
It would have been better not to have known the way of truth than having known it to depart from it. Those are the most startling of sounding words in Peter.
Yeah.
Talk so much about evangelism, but then this concerning those who are saved. God says it'd be better him go ahead and go to hell, ignorant of Christ, than be knowledgeable about Christ and go to hell.
Yeah. This is something that all of us can get involved in. Number three, where do we need to lead? Leaders must lead in the area of financial stewardship. We've talked a lot in this congregation, thankfully, about stewardship. Think about these four ideas, inherent ideas, as he calls them, in stewardship. First of all, there's divine ownership, which means everything we have, everything around us, it belongs to God. He owns it. But then he took everything that he owns and he has endowed it to humans. He's not here cutting your grass. Don't you wish he was? He's not here, taking care of your home. So he's endowed it to humans, and he expects faithful administration of those things. He's entrusted us. Can you believe that? If you had created the world, would you entrust it to people like us? Be like, I don't know about these people. And then obviously, the fourth part of this is there is an inevitable accounting, which means the day is going to come where we are called to give an answer for how we have managed things. And he's not talking there specifically about whether you cut your grass or not, or whether you took care of your home. He's talking about more than that. He's talking about in letter five, even our own children, how we used our time, how we used our talents, how we used our money, making sure that we are proper stewards of everything that God has put in our care. And again, that applies not just to elders and what they do in the church. That applies to all of us. How do others see us being a good example in how to take care of the things that God has blessed us with in this life? Page 91, number four. Leaders must lead in the area of discipline. I like letter A, and this is something we say often, but I don't think we can say it enough. Church discipline. If you don't know what that's talking about, withdrawing of fellowship. The withdrawing of fellowship is not an eldership action. It is a congregational action. Now, letter B says the leaders must lead in the implementation of it, but it's not just an eldership thing. And I think sometimes people get that idea because the elders are the ones who are leading the church. The elders are the ones who are getting up and making the announcements, making the pleas to the congregation. But the two main passages, not the only two passages, but the two main passages where we read about withdrawal of fellowship are in 1 Corinthians 5 and 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Which one of those passages is addressed to the elders of the church? Which one of those passages says, elders, here's what you need to do? Neither one. Now, they're being addressed to congregations that no doubt had elders in them, and yet it's being addressed to the congregation. What does that say? This isn't just a thing that the elders are doing. This is a thing that the congregation is involved in. The elders are leading us by instruction. They're leading us by example. And so it's not just that the elders are getting up and saying words and telling what to do, but they are showing us what to do as well. But what does that say about us as members of a congregation? What if we don't? What if we are not a part of the withdrawal? What if, you know, others engage in it, but we say, no, I'm not going to really do this. You know, it doesn't seem right to me. I don't agree with this. What does that example do for others in the congregation? What does that example do for the one who's been withdrawn from? Wow. The church withdrew from me, but so-and-so, they haven't withdrawn from me. What message does that send? I don't know the answer to that question. It's going to be a mixed message for sure. But the point of what's the point of withdrawal of fellowship? What is its purpose? To bring them back, to save them. I mean, that's the 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 says it's designed to create shame, to wake them up, so that 1 Corinthians chapter 5, their soul might be saved in the day of judgment. That's its purpose. And so do I want them to be saved? Am I setting an example that shows how much I want them to be saved? And so leaders, and this is for all of us, we've got to set an example in the area of discipline. Now, number five, this word is in quotation marks for your blank here, and it's in quotation marks for a reason, because you're not going to like the word, but let me explain, or let Brother Winkler explain what he means by this. Leaders must lead in the area of indoctrination. I told you you wouldn't like the word, all right? But what does he mean by that? Simply stated, what does that mean, letter A? It means to put the doctrine in, all right? So what do we need to do in the church? We need to teach the doctrine of Christ. That is of utmost importance. It's not just something that happens in a classroom or in the pulpit, but it is something that needs to happen in our daily lives, that people understand that we stand for truth, that we're interested only in the doctrine of Christ. And when it comes to the congregation of the Lord's church, we are trying to put the doctrine of Christ in. Now, don't take that and think that's all that we do. Is that all that the church is doing, is just putting doctrine of Christ in? Is that all that the church is supposed to do? Well, it's not all that the church is supposed to do. How did Jesus say that people would know that we are his disciples? Because we put the doctrine in? We stood firm on the doctrine of Christ? Is that how he said people would know we are disciples? And John chapter 13, they'll know you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And so there has to be a complete package that people are seeing, a complete package that people are grasping when it comes to the church. And so that has to be a good balance between making sure we're standing for the doctrine of Christ, but we're also showing it in love. And so how did Paul say to preach the truth in Ephesians 4 and verse 15? Preach the truth in love. And so there's got to be that balance. But we've got to be setting a good example and putting the teaching doctrine and going back to those fundamentals and making sure that those are being fortified every opportunity. Number six, leaders must lead in the area of preacher training. If our mission is to take the gospel to the world, shouldn't we want more people doing that? When was the last time you encouraged one of our boys, one of our young men, to be a preacher? Is that something that any of us could do? I know preachers aren't the coolest people in the world, and preachers have a pretty boring life because they only work 1.5 days a week, and preachers aren't the wealthiest people on earth, and I know all of the stories and all of the downsides, I guess, people would think of being a preacher. But guess what this world needs more of? It needs more guys who are preaching. Guess what the Lord's church is losing at a disturbing rate right now? Preachers. And good, solid, sound preachers. And so we need to work on helping men to want to become preachers. How do we do that? On top of page 92, and this is Brother Winkler's words, we need to restore the glory and importance of preaching. Notice he doesn't say the preacher. There's nothing glorious and important about the preacher. But we need to restore the glory and importance of preaching. You think about Romans chapter 10, says that whoever calls in the name of the Lord shall be saved. Well, how shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? How shall they believe on him in whom they have not heard? How shall they hear without a preacher? Now, that's not talking about just the guy who's getting paid to do it. That's talking about all of us. But is there a need for more preachers? Number three, we must remove the negative perception of preaching. I don't think there's one here at Palm Beach Lakes, but in general, is there a negative perception of preaching? I think in some homes, there's a really negative perception of preaching. I think in some homes, the very last thing a little boy would ever grow up to be is a preacher, because all they ever hear is about negative stuff about the preacher. They hear it in the car, they hear it, going home from church, whatever. And so the very last thought that a little boy would have, I mean, he might think about, becoming a drug dealer before he'd ever think about becoming a preacher. I mean, no, that's far-fetched. But I mean, if all they ever hear is just downer negative stuff about, well, why would I ever want to become a preacher? We ought to look at our boys and say, okay, what can we do to encourage these guys? And are the majority of them going to become preachers? No, that's not going to happen. But what if we don't encourage any of them to become a preacher? Should we be surprised if none of them are? So this is an area that all of us can take an active role in, just encouraging our young men to become preachers. Number seven, leaders must lead in the area of personal development. Two things he mentions here about personal development. One is leaders need to lead in the area of faith development. Do elders and deacons and preachers, once you reach the level, right, of being an elder, deacon, and preacher, or preacher in the church, I mean, you've reached a stage where you can just kind of coast. I mean, you can just like, all right, I've reached that level. And once you're at that stage, maybe Bible study isn't as necessary anymore. Maybe prayer isn't as necessary anymore because you're there, right? Man, definitely wrong. And so is there a need for personal faith development even in the lives of those who are leaders in the church? Yeah, which says there's that need for everybody in the church. And then the second area he mentions is leaders need to lead in relationship development. Leaders need to be good husbands and wives, good fathers and mothers, good Christians within the church and outside of the church. And that responsibility is an ongoing need in the church. Anybody got any comments? I've run through a bunch of these. That's 7 out of 18. But anybody got any comments or thoughts on any of these? Share Lamb. It is not too far-fetched. What causes somebody to be a preacher? Are they born with a special chip in their head? Got extra space for Bible verses and anybody can become a preacher. I mean, look at this. Do they need to desire it? Yeah. Do they need to want to do it more than anything else? Yeah. But that can be fostered in their hearts even from a young age. And I don't know where it started with me. Somebody stuck that thought in my head when I was too young to even know who I was. And if that was, I don't even know if it was Dean Reynolds, but probably my grandfather above anybody else. But you plant that little seed of a thought in a little boy's head, and it's hard to get that out. Anyway, give that some thought. Page 93. Go ahead.
Being able to teach.
Absolutely.
And even being able to, on occasion, do a lesson or something, even if you're not the full-time guy up there all the time.
Absolutely.
You can set those expectations even if it's not a full-time preacher.
Absolutely. What do congregations need? Well, they need preachers. What else do they need? They need strong Bible knowledge men who are able to teach, able to recognize sound doctrine and false doctrine, who are able to step into a classroom, who are able to encourage others. So absolutely, 100% on that. Dan?
Yeah, I'm like you. I never decided to be a preacher. I grew up in a congregation where preachers were heroes. And I've always wanted to be a preacher. And that's, West Huntsville produced 22 preachers, a little congregation, 200 members in my generation. I don't mean 30 or 40 years. I'm just talking about those right above me and those right behind me. 22 preachers came out of a congregation of 200. And it's the atmosphere. And there's with some 5, 6, and 70-year-old boys. I'm telling you, we owe it to them. We absolutely, absolutely owe that to them. The other thing is, we don't need to pressure them. Mm-hmm. My dad would have been a preacher had not my grandfather pushed him to be a preacher, and it was a rebellion against him. And I remember Ryan Brackett, Ron asked him one time, and he wasn't pushing him at all. He said, "Are you going to be a preacher when you grow up?" He said, "No, I'm going to be a Christian." And I think that's classic. And I told my sons, if you want to be happy, you preach. But I'm telling you, what I want you to be is not a preacher. I want you to be a faithful Christian.
Yeah. And Diane, you're exactly right. And I don't want to leave the impression you or Grayson or anybody that that's the only path is telling our young men to be preachers. Sometimes if you don't plant a seed, then what can you expect to get? So the seed's got to be there, and just that seed of wanting to be a faithful leader in the church, whatever capacity. That's in. Number 8, top of page 93. Leaders must lead in the area of self-control. This is so important. One of the qualifications to be an elder is to be not quick-tempered. That's tough. Leaders must control their tongues. They've got to control their passions. They've got to control their attitudes. They've got to control. I mean, this is easy, right? I mean, check this off. This isn't a no-brainer. I mean, this is just super, super simple, no? They've got to control their behaviors. Is this automatic? I mean, because if you're an elder or a deacon or a preacher in the church, this is just like, duh. I mean, this is automatic for you. Of course you control your temper and your tongue and your attitude. Does the devil continue to strive to come after each and every one of us? Yeah. And Titus chapter 2 is not written to a group of elders or a group of deacons, but it says that we are, that the grace of God in Titus chapter 2 is teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. While we're doing that, what are we doing? We're looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ. So we need to be zealous for good works. And that needs to be each of us. And obviously, when others see that in our lives and we set that example, they will strive to follow that example as well. Okay. Number 9. Leaders must lead in the area of morality. This is becoming increasingly hard, isn't it? God's children have been called to be holy. Remember what God said, "Be holy as I, the Lord your God, am holy." And so others need to look at us. And again, this applies not just to elders, deacons, and preachers. This is everybody. What do young people need to see in the church? They need to see Christians who are living a moral life because they want to, because that's where their heart is, not because they're forced into it. And so what holiness means is these two prepositions. I used to think that holiness meant, well, I'm set apart from the world, and that's true, but that's just part of it. That's just half of it. To be holy, yes, I'm set apart from the world. I'm different from the world. Okay, but now what am I? If I'm different from the world, then I'm not like them. What am I? I'm set apart to God, to Christ, to His service. And that's the second half of that. And so get both of those prepositions in your mind that yes, holiness is to be different and set apart from the world, but then what? It's to be set apart to the service of God. And so he says, leaders must show that it's possible to live above the world and all of its lusts. The ways of this world should not be a part of a leader's manner of life. And I love the way Ephesians 5 has this. The things of the world are not fitting for the saints of God. I love that expression in Ephesians 5. You know, that do you have clothes in your closet that don't fit anymore? Too big, too small, you know, whatever. God says there's some things that the Christian used to wear. It doesn't fit the Christian anymore. And that's that context of Ephesians. The whole context of Ephesians 5 is putting off the old man and putting on the new man. You put off the old man, he doesn't fit anymore. That's this area of living a different life. And young people in this church need to see this in all of us. And they need to see us loving the life that we live of just doing what's right. Page 94, number 10. Leaders must lead in the area, you would expect this, right? In the area of church attendance. This is one of those things that you don't realize the example you're setting until maybe somebody draws it to your attention, or maybe until you're not setting that example anymore. There's just some people you expect to be at services all of the time. And then when they become less inclined to that habit, do people take notice? The people that you would normally expect to be here, and then all of a sudden they say, well, you know, so-and-so's not coming on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. What's the big deal? What's just happened? So-and-so never said anything with their words to this person. Hey, you don't need to, probably. Didn't say anything to somebody. Oh, you don't have to go on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. But what did their example just do? Their example just spoke volumes. And by not being here, it just told somebody, hey, you don't have to be here. That example can be rather devastating, because maybe some individual has some reason that they're not here that's not even known, and yet we live upon somebody's example and say, okay, well, they're not here, so I don't need to be here. And of course, talking to everybody who's here on a Sunday night, so you get this, right? But we've got to set that example. Number 11, this is all of us. Leaders must lead in the area of involvement. So not just attending, not just sitting in the pew, but being involved. Every member of the human body, your hands, your feet, your fingers, your ears, has something to contribute to the good of the body. That's the same way with the body of Christ. Every member needs to be involved somehow, somewhere in the work, so that it can contribute to the good of the body. And so the blank on letter C is leaders need to first be actively involved and participating in the works and the activities of the church themselves. Then they need to help others to get involved. You know, it's one of those things where they need to see us involved before we go and try to get them to become involved with it. It's interesting, the last point he has here on this page. Leaders set the wrong example when they fail to show up at church events. The members will wonder if the leader thinks he is above the mundane. Do you know who Matthew 23 is talking about? Jesus is talking to a certain group of people. Remember who he was talking to in Matthew 23? Listing a bunch of woes against the scribes and the Pharisees. And in those verses in Matthew chapter 23, it talks about the scribes and the Pharisees, and it says, they say and they do not do. They're really good with their words. This is what you ought to do. But when it comes down to actually doing what needs to be done, it says they don't do it. He says, they bind heavy burdens upon you. They lay these burdens upon man's shoulders. But then Jesus says about them, they won't even lift a finger to do anything themselves. Do people ever see that in us, that maybe we're strong with our words but not as strong with our example? Page 95, number 12. Boy, we only have 5 minutes left.
Hey, David, one thing
I
think is great about all these is none of this means you have to be the person in charge.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Being a leader can be every single person in the building.
Absolutely. And often, you know, those are the ones that can have the greater daily constant impact. And so absolutely, great point. So this is all of us. Leaders need to lead in the area of fellowship. What does that involve? Well, it involves visiting people in their homes. That's just a lost art anymore, isn't it? You know, you got these gated communities. You can't even get into their house without their permission, right? Into their neighborhood without permission or whatever it is. But have we lost the art of visiting people? Visiting people in their homes, visiting them in the hospital, just being hospitable. Are we as hospitable as we used to be? Well, maybe not getting into their homes. What about just arriving early to services or arriving late? Or not arriving late, we do that. Staying late. Arriving early and staying late. And I think everybody in this room is expert at that. I mean, I think the 30-minute members that we have in this congregation, folks who get here 30 minutes early, folks who are here 30 minutes after, so I mean, how many people in this congregation fit into one of those categories? They're here either 30 minutes early or they stay even 30 minutes out. I mean, you know when you leave here on a Sunday night, Wednesday night, and you go out to your car, most of you are not the last ones to get to your car. I mean, we've got folks that, I mean, if they had a tent, they might stay out in the parking lot. I don't know. But that's, we need to be leaders in that. We need to set the example in this regard and allow others to see this is what's important to me. I love number 13. Leaders must lead in the area of intercessory prayer. God tells us to pray for one another. Do you know the power that you have in your words when you tell somebody, I'm praying for you? Those are my, I hate to say favorite because there's probably something else that might be more favorite. Those are like my favorite words to hear. When somebody says, I'm praying for you, I'm not sure that they could tell me anything better. You know, sometimes, you know, we'll say to somebody, you know, what can I do for you? Oh, well, I don't. They'll say, I don't really think there's anything I can do that you can do for me. Just pray for me. Well, that's the least I can do. No, it's not. You're talking to the creator of this universe. That's the most you can do, is talk to God. But what a thing to tell somebody I'm praying for you, or to ask somebody, hey, you know, what can I be praying for you? What is there that's going on in your life that I can be praying for you? Or asking other folks to pray for you. You know, there are certain people in this church. You know some of them. There are certain people in this church. You know they pray privately. Men, women, young and old in this church. You know certain folks who pray on their own privately because you can tell it. You can just tell it in their lives. So what about asking them to pray for you? Letter D, a church that prays for one another. Think about this. I put a star next to this. The church that prays for one another has the power of God holding it together and blessing it daily. Do you believe that? This church doesn't belong to us. This church doesn't belong to any one of us. This church belongs to Christ. This church belongs to God, and He's the one who's going to make something of us. Let me get through this. Boy, we got 2 minutes. I've got five more to get through. All right, let me give these to you quick. Y'all ready to write? All right, here we go. Leaders must lead in the area of devotion to biblical truth. We kind of touched on this a little bit already, but in this postmodern world that we live in, you know truth is relative. That's not true, and you know it's not true. There is absolute truth, and we need to stand up for absolute truth. We need to have your second blank there in letter B. We need to have an uncompromising loyalty to the truth of God. And we can't allow people to make us feel ashamed or embarrassed or second guess that God's truth is absolute truth. Now, do we do this in the pulpit? Yes. But we do this in our everyday life. When we draw a line in our everyday life and say, this is where I stand. This is what I'll do and what I won't do. This is what I believe and what I won't believe. And we don't budge from that. What does that say? Truth is not relative. Truth is absolute. So you have those blanks. Hope you got those blanks. Number 15. Leaders must lead in the area of promoting unity. I love Psalm 133. Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. That was written 3,000 years ago. Is that still true today? I'm thankful for the unity that exists at Palm Beach Lakes. It is good and it is pleasant for the unity we have here in the whole congregation, between the elders among themselves, between the elders and the members. You know what? Unity may not be something that you think about very often here because it's just a given. How often do you think about the fact you're breathing oxygen? It's just there, right? I mean, you're breathing oxygen, it's just there. You don't even think about it. Unity in this church, you probably don't think about it very often. Why? Because it's just there. Guess what you might think about at some point if it's not there? I mean, if you didn't have oxygen, if you were in a room that didn't have oxygen, what would you only be thinking about? Oxygen. May God help us to never reach a point where we don't have that unity. Number 16, and we've got to stop, so let me give these to you quick. Jesus is our perfect example. Jesus was a leader who took the lead. And I love Acts 1 and verse 1. Of all, Jesus began both to do and to teach. Jesus set the example in doing, and then after he did, he came and taught, okay, here's why you need to do what I am doing for you. Jesus is our perfect example of a leader who took the lead. Page 98, number 17. If you're going to talk about Jesus, who comes in second place? The Apostle Paul understood that leaders lead by example. And that's the whole lesson we're talking about today. Rarely our words have been discussed here today. Mostly our lifestyle, our behavior, our choices. So leaders lead by example. And then finally, number 18, leading by example is a vital part of the leader's role. He's got to set a high standard. Don't lower their standard. Sometimes we lower standards for our kids because we think, oh, well, they'll never reach that. You set a standard for kids and they're going to reach it. They will climb for it. So don't lower your threshold of the example you're setting for others. Live a life of integrity that's worthy of imitation. I know that's a lot of information. Had to race through the last bit of it. But as we've said, this isn't just for elders, deacons, preachers, or whoever else. This, I think, all of these 18 apply to all of us. Thank you all. We're a couple of minutes over. Thank you for being here.